Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I speak to old Eds from both the boys and girls school about their lives and their careers since they crossed Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. My name is Ben Anderson and I was a managing editor in the radio industry. I ran three radio stations for Capital FM before leaving to start my own business, Sound Rebel. We're a podcast production company and this is one of my very favourite podcasts to do. Today I am joined by the founder of LookUp Communications, a communications and content consultancy working with leaders in business, technology and sport. He's also an author and a journalist. There's many strings to this man's bow and I'm looking forward to speaking to him about a lot of them. Nick Varley, who left in 1986. Welcome to Ed Talks.
Hi Ben, thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
How's your week been? We're recording this on a Friday, Nick. Busy week for you this week?
It has. I had the first time in about 4 years yesterday, I got a train in rush hour, which was something that was a bit of a shock to the system. So I had a day out in Cardiff talking about the UEFA 28 football tournament with some various members of the various football associations in the UK.
I cannot wait to start talking about your career now, because I'm a big sports fan myself, especially football. You look at the LookUp Communications website, some of the people and teams that you've worked with, London 2012 is on there, Rio 2016, Tokyo 2020, Paris 2024, the Commonwealth Games, Birmingham 2022, of course. We'll talk about all of that shortly, but before we do, I'd love to take you back to the 80s when you were a student at King Edward School. Nick, what was your experience at King Edward's like?
It's funny. It's only when you got in touch and we were talking about this that I've really thought back to it very much, really. I suppose that's the nature of life, isn't it? That you live in the present and not the past. But it was slightly scary at times, but overall fantastic. I came from a very small state Catholic primary school in Streatley, and I was the only person in my year who went to King Edward's. I was the first person ever to go to King Edward's. And so I went from this homely little primary school where I knew everyone and everyone's families knew everyone else's families, and we all saw each other at church on the weekend, to this distant, austere, huge school that seemed massive to me at the time, and of course was on the other side of Birmingham. So at the age of 11, I remember catching a bus and then a train and then walking all the way from my house to the other side of Birmingham. And I guess that's what it gave me most of all, was that sense of, you know, of independence, of having to do it for yourself, because, you know, it certainly was a big learning curve, aged 11, to be traipsing across the city at rush hour on rickety old 1980s West Midlands Transport trains and buses. But yeah, overall, I look back at it really fondly.
What was Birmingham like in the 80s, Nick, as a city? Were you out much? Or were you always playing sport?
It's funny because, again, looking back on this and listening to the excellent podcast you did with Neil Moxley, who was in the year below me, and I knew I used to play cricket with him, and I've worked with him over the years as we were both journalists at one point. Birmingham in the 80s was a funny place because, you know, I started school actually in 79. My first term was 79. And so that was about 6 months after Margaret Thatcher was elected. And so there was this, you know, this sense of shift going on in the whole country, as well as, you know, not only Birmingham, but you had this sense of shift going on, and the Thatcher government and the, you know, in 81, there was the riots in Liverpool and elsewhere. And then in 85, there were more riots, not remembered so much, but in Birmingham. And I remember being on the bus coming home from school, going through the middle of a riot in Handsworth. And so the 80s sort of, the first half of the 80s were fairly politically and sort of economically and socially a fairly dark time, really. Although, ironically, at the same time, it was incredibly creative and musically. I was very much into music. I still am very much into music. But you had all these great bands in Birmingham and the Midlands who were making huge headlines, you know, from The Beat and Specials and Dexys Midnight Runners. I remember seeing Dexys Midnight Runners on the edge of a New Street station doing a photo shoot one day on the way into school. So you had this kind of dark political context, but a sort of real sort of creative idea that Birmingham was quite a creative place and was bubbling up with ideas. So that was the first half of the 80s. And then the second half of the 80s was a bit more beige, I guess. There was less extremes, but you had this sort of sense that Birmingham was slightly in decline, you know, that British Leyland was on its way out. Longbridge was sort of heading towards what ultimately became closure in the 90s. And there was almost this sense that Birmingham was being supplanted by Manchester as the second city, and the sort of civic pride was on the decline, and so on and so forth. So I think, fast forwarding right now, it's superb. I was back in Birmingham a couple of weeks ago. My parents are still there, and I go back fairly regularly for work and whatnot. And it's amazing to see the renaissance of Birmingham now, and the fact that, you know, we've gone full circle. I live in Kent, and my son is looking at where he wants to settle down, and he's thinking about Birmingham. So, you know, it's now a city that attracts young people. It's the most diverse city in Europe. I think the youngest city in Europe. So
it is.
The vibrancy it has now is quite different to what it had when I was there, in certainly the first half of the 80s.
I'd love to talk about how things like hosting the Commonwealth Games helps that feeling. But I'm jumping ahead. What did you do after you left school?
So I left school. I did science A-levels, kind of because I had to. I wanted to do a mix of science and arts A-levels. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's true now, but at the time, the school didn't really encourage that. You were encouraged to do either arts or sciences. So I did science A-levels. But then I went off to university and actually did a politics and then economic history degree. So I had very odd sort of education in that sense of, you know, physics, maths and chemistry to A-level, and then going off to do something that was entirely disconnected at university. But the main thing I did at university that was more important than my degree, really, was that I got involved in student journalism. And so I started writing for I went to Sheffield University, which had a very good student newspaper. So I started writing for that, and then, you know, doing some editing, and ultimately ended up being the editor of it for one term. It was a new editor every term. So, and that's how I got into. I didn't really know, at 18 when I left school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't really have a clear idea. And over the course of my degree and being in Sheffield, that's when I decided, you know, that I wanted to do journalism, and I started getting some very good experience as student journalism. I mean, I'm not sure that pathway to doing it even exists in the same way anymore, but it certainly, you know, was the way I got into the business as a job ultimately, was by having lots of great cuttings and great experience while I was at uni.
Let's talk about LookUp Communications. You work with some incredible brands, Nick. Where would you like to begin?
Well, so, I mean, having qualified as a journalist, I've worked as a journalist for about 15 years or so. My dream job when I decided on journalism was I wanted to work on The Guardian. I wanted to be a reporter on The Guardian. And I achieved that in my sort of late 20s, just about touching 30, I think. And I was actually sports correspondent on The Guardian for a couple of years.
Fabulous.
And then after that, I wrote a book, wrote a couple of books, actually, and was doing freelance work and so on and so forth. So that got us to about 2003. And I'd kind of done what I wanted to do in journalism in some ways. I didn't really see that, you know, I'd worked in The Guardian and you know, had that experience. I'd written some books and had that experience. And so I wasn't really sure what I was doing. I was kind of a little bit of a career crossroads. And then all of a sudden, London decided to bid for the Olympics. And kind of in a sort of serendipitous way, my next door neighbour, when we lived in Birmingham, my parents still live in the same house, was the guy who ran Birmingham's bid for the Olympics in 1986, because Birmingham tried to host in 92. And I had done some volunteering with him. I'd gone around leafleting and been involved, because I just thought hosting the Olympics would be brilliant for Birmingham. I think it'd be fantastic.
So, and of course, this is while you were still at school or just about to leave.
Still at school. Yeah. Still at school, sitting in sixth form. So, of course, it didn't happen, unfortunately. Barcelona did host. But I'd always had this kind of strange kind of obsession that said, you know, I'd love for the UK to host the Olympics, because I loved it. I remember vividly listening to the Moscow Olympics in 1980 when Seb Coe won his gold medal, because we were on holiday in Cornwall and my dad parked the car up and we all listened in the radio in the car because it was such a big moment, you know. So I always had this kind of bizarre, you know, I'd love to work on an Olympics bid. And then London put its hat into the ring very late in the day and in a slightly shambolic way. And I just wrote a speculative letter to a bloke whose name I found somewhere or other, because he was quoted in the paper or something. And to cut a long story short, I got a short-term contract to help them launch their brand spanking new cutting edge technology website, which in 2003 was, blimey, really cutting edge. And I got a 3-month contract to help them do that and then never left from the bid. So I ended up doing all of the sort of written bid collateral and marketing materials, and ended up writing all the speeches for the big final presentation that had to be delivered to the International Olympic Committee members to try and convince them to vote for London. So I ended up writing the speeches for Seb Coe and for Ken Livingstone and for Tony Blair. And, you know, I'd never done speech writing in my life, but, you know, I knew I could write. So it was kind of just an adventure and a new skill. And of course, when London won, somewhat unexpectedly, it has to be said, everyone who was connected with it was in demand from bidding cities elsewhere in the world and so on and so forth. So that's when I had my years as being a consultant. It was firstly in a company called 746, which is my company, and then more recently in LookUp, going around the world working on bids, helping them define what their story was, you know, mapping out what their vision was, why they wanted to host, and helping them sort of tell their story. And it was, I mean, the most random left field career turn you could imagine, and an incredibly niche one at that, but really fantastic. So as you say, I worked in London and then Rio and then Tokyo and most recently Paris. And I think I'm the only person in the world who's worked on 4 successive winning Olympic bids. I think that's my really minor claim to fame.
It's a fabulous claim to fame.
It's a very niche claim to fame, let's put it that way.
Isn't it lovely as well that it's a claim to fame that's based on, you know, based in the history. You were thinking about this when you were 18 years old. Wouldn't it be fabulous if the UK hosted Olympics and then you actually were there writing the speeches to help make this thing happen?
The best day of my working life without question was the day that that London won. It was an astonishing day for what that team achieved, from a standing start to bring home the games. And then I didn't stay around and get involved in the delivery, but then the delivery of what they actually put on was an absolute triumph 10 years ago, of course, this summer.
Crazy.
Is incredible, really, to think that was 10 years ago.
I'd like to talk about the process, because obviously there are kind of lots of kind of economic benefits. There are status benefits. Like, why does a city like London, why do people want the Olympics? Kind of taking it back to its very core, why does someone want to put their hat in the ring and try and win votes to be voted Olympic city, for example, Paris in 2024?
I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, it's often, you know, you can't be completely definitive about it, because it does vary from country to country. Some countries purely want to do it because it's the biggest event in the world. It's the most prestigious event in the world. Hosting the Olympics, you know, sadly not for Tokyo during COVID, but any other time, you know, the entire world is watching you and your country, your city and your country. You know, you are the capital of the world for those probably, you know, 6 to 8 weeks in one summer every 4 years. There is, you know, everyone remembers London, everyone remembers Rio and Tokyo. So some countries are very much all about, you know, just the reflected glory of hosting the world's biggest event. And that's definitely, you know, China in 2008 was the Beijing Olympics in 2008 was a coming out party to say, we are China, we are here.
So almost kind of political motivations there.
Oh, yeah. The sports, I'm a firm believer that, you know, this idea that sports and politics don't mix is nonsense. Sports and politics are intertwined at every single moment of every single day. It's sports has an incredible power. Because of that power, politicians are interested in it. So, you know, whether that's in terms of profile or platform or whatever else. So, you know, so you have some countries that do it because they want the kudos, if that's not an oversimplistic way of looking at it. But then for other countries, you know, and I think London is possibly the best example ever of this, is that you have politicians and sports administrators kind of united, because they realize that if they channel this incredible event correctly, they can achieve enormous change. And I don't know how well you or anyone who's listened to this would know East London before the Olympics, but it was it's the worst deprivation I've ever seen in this country. You know, I've travelled this country quite a lot for work, working in various different towns and cities. And the East End, that part of the East End of London was, a Victorian industrial site that had been in decay and decline for decades, generations and generations of people without, you know, much hope. And you know, the ground was toxic. You know, they literally had to dig out all the soil and wash it clean because it was so full of chemicals and all the rest of it. So, you know, you look at London, that part of London now, and you think, well, what was delivered there from a socio-economic point of view was an entire regeneration of one of the world's biggest and most successful cities. So that's an incredible socio-economic political achievement. So that kind of legacy thing is very much part of the mix for some cities, but also the profile as well, and the general feel-good factor. There was a market research, piece of market research done after the London Olympics, because the London 2012 team were very keen on, you know, making sure they were in touch with how people felt about the Games. And I think at the end of the Paralympics, the end of the London 2012 summer, people were asked, you know, did you support, or, you know, were you against the Olympics? Did you think it was a good idea? And the response was 98%, yes, we thought it was a great idea. Wow. You know, in a Western democracy, nothing gets 98% approval ratings. So, you know, that shows the power of these things when they're done well, to give that sort of that sense of national unity and national pride. And that reflects in your sort of place in the world, I think. Without getting too political about anything, it's a shame that we seem to have regressed since 2012 in some ways in terms of how we feel about ourselves and our place in the world. But there we go.
So you said earlier that London was a late entry into that kind of the bid. Is it can you say competition, bidding process?
Yes. Yeah, it's a competition. Absolutely, it's the biggest competition in the world.
And they were late in, and they weren't particularly. When you first started, it wasn't likely that it would happen. Who were you up against for that London 2012 bid?
It was a fairly heavyweight contest. So London was against New York, Paris, Madrid, and Moscow, which is a fairly impressive roster. And, you know, Paris were red hot favourites for a number of reasons, and were absolutely gutted that they didn't win. And you know, they lost by a tiny fraction, photo finish.
You helped to put the story together. What was the story for London? Because I imagine, you know, you've talked about some of the benefits, like the regeneration of East London. Is that what the Olympic Committee are interested in, the awarding committee?
No. So you have in effect, for all of these bids, you have two audiences. You have a domestic audience who need to be convinced that this is a good use of taxpayers' money, because, you know, running a bid campaign can be, certainly in the old days, it's a lot more streamlined now, but in the old days, could be quite expensive. So you have to convince your domestic audience that there is a good reason to spend this money to deliver some benefits to them, which is where, in London's case, the regeneration story was so important. From the International Olympic Committee's point of view, of course, what they want most of all is somewhere that they can rely upon to host great games. So that's kind of important, but it's a given. And the domestic sort of story is a nice to have, and it's important. But actually what they want to know is, well, what are you going to do for us? And when they say us, what they really mean is, what are you going to do for international sport? How are you going to help us make sure that we survive and remain relevant and grow and profile the athletes and make sure that this, in some ways, very strange thing, you know, that brings together lots of sports that that lots of people don't really watch every, you know, in the 3 years in between, and then all of a sudden everyone becomes an expert in, you know, taekwondo or one pentathlon or whatever, and we're all obsessed by it. So they're interested in you know, what's the story that how you benefit the Olympic movement, and London's story was very clear that and you saw it at the time of the Games on the banners that were everywhere. London's story was that, you know, London as a global city that communicated to the world, you know, if you brought your sports event here, London would push out that inspiration and inspire a new generation of young people all around the world because taking the games to London takes it to a cool city that's got a global media platform and then connects with young people. And hence the phrase was London 2012 Inspire a Generation. And that was the work we did that got used during the bid. You know, very much coming very eloquently and coming from the soul and the heart of Seb Coe, who lived it and breathed it and embodied it, because that's how his, you know, career had started. And he believed, you know, it was almost like a religion to him and others that, you know, this is what we have to do. And then it stayed all the way through. So it worked for the bid in terms of, you know, getting the win. And then it stayed in place over the entire 7 years of the buildings and all the rest of it. So that in London 2012, the message still was Inspire a Generation. So, yeah, it was a very effective messaging.
Was that your line, Nick? Inspire a Generation?
No. One of the things that I hate about this world is that because it's consultancy, everyone takes credit for the good stuff and denies they had anything to do with the bad stuff. You know, it's the old cliche that success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. The truth of any Olympic bid or any successful venture in any form, really, is that it's teamwork. And the London 2012 team, you know, was the most incredible team I ever worked with. You know, because we all came from very different backgrounds, and you know, it was a ragbag bunch who turned up from lots of different places. And that it was a team, and the team was superbly led by Seb and by Keith Mills, who was the chief executive. And I think the greatest thing you can say about it is that lots of people involved in it have gone on to do have very successful careers, do very big jobs elsewhere in the sporting world. Several of whom are working directly for the IOC now. So no, yeah, I'm never going to take credit for one line. It's teamwork all the way.
It's a fantastic line, isn't it? It's so simple. It sounds like an incredibly complicated process, as you can imagine, bidding for the Olympic Games. But just being able to simplify it to that, such a strong message, Inspire a Generation. Nick, do you remember what Paris's story was? You said it was a close contest with Paris. Do you remember what they were talking about at the time?
Paris's phrase was Paris needs the games, Paris loves the games, which we always thought was a very bad sort of positioning because they were talking about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not what the voters want. The voters want you to be talking about the big picture, not you know, facing outward and looking forward rather than facing inward. And that was always Paris's Achilles heel for that big campaign. But, you know, having said that, and of course I was involved in the Paris 24 bid, you know, the Paris Games that are coming up in a couple of years now will be incredible. Some of the stuff that they're putting on in terms of mass participation events and having an opening ceremony that goes down the Seine are just going to be so mind-blowingly spectacular that I think they're going to take the whole thing to another level.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
Nick, I'd love to talk now about Birmingham 2022. Incredibly exciting for the city. We spoke to Ian Metcalf a couple of months back now, who's the chief executive of Commonwealth Games England. And he was talking to us about Birmingham 2022. What's been your involvement with the bidding process and everything else that's going on with Birmingham 22?
I got involved in the bid phase. I mean, what often happens in my work is that we do quite a lot of work during a bid. And then once the bid is won, the need for communications, the need for narrative and the stuff that we do just disappears off a cliff. It's not needed anymore. What you need once you've won an event is architects and planners and transport experts and security experts and accommodation experts and all of those people who deliver the real meat of it, the nuts and bolts that actually means the event can happen. So with Birmingham, it was a fairly typical example, to be honest. We got involved. This was my previous company, but me and a couple of guys from my company then were involved. We helped Birmingham define its story. We worked very closely with the bid team leadership and with Councillor Ian Ward, leader of the council, to help Birmingham firstly see off Liverpool, because there was an internal UK competition for this to see which UK city was going to be the successful one. So and there was a,
yes,
an internal.
It was a tricky time for me personally, being from Birmingham, living yeah, in sure. Liverpool, because up here they were convinced that they had it in the bag.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there we are. Overconfidence can be an enemy. So there's that internal contest, Beauty Parade. So we helped sort of do the sort of the sell of Birmingham's plan for that. And then once Birmingham was selected as the preferred UK bidder, we continued to work with them to sort of refine that story for the Commonwealth Games Federation itself. Of course, there was no other international competitor to bid against. It was an undisputed contest. But, you know, the Commonwealth Games Federation still put Birmingham through the hoops to make sure that everything stacked up and that they weren't just handing it over to something that was an undercooked plan. So we worked probably on and off over the course of a year or so with the bid team. And then Birmingham won the right to host just before Christmas in 2017, I think. And I sort of stayed in touch on and off, just keeping involved at a distance. But of course, then COVID came down and everything. I mean, it is quite remarkable the job that has been done by the Birmingham bid team. You know, Ian Reid's the chief executive, and Ian McCarthy, as you mentioned, from Commonwealth Games England, and but everyone involved to actually get that event happening this summer after the times we've lived through is quite remarkable. And I think I'm obviously massively excited by it anyway, but the fact it's going to be the first global event post-COVID where you will have things back to normal, full crowds, you know, is fantastic. If anyone listening to this hasn't got tickets yet, get onto it, because it'll be a marvellous thing to be involved with. And, you know, I think it really is. Here we are, what, 35 years after that Birmingham Olympic bid. I mean, this is probably the greatest, Birmingham's greatest moment in the sun, certainly on the global sporting stage, that it's ever had, probably ever will have, to be honest, because, you know, I don't think it could host an Olympics. I don't think you could go bigger. And so the Commonwealth Games is probably the biggest event you'll host. But yeah, it's start of a really exciting period. And of course, then I'm sure there'll be lots of plans about doing follow-up events, using the facilities for other events, you know, making sure that they have that legacy and community involvement and other major events brought in as well. So, yeah, fantastic.
So what was Birmingham's story that we told to the Commonwealth Games Federation?
It was less of a classic bid campaign, because there wasn't an international rival, and so there wasn't going to be a vote to try and win. But the story was very much based around Birmingham's diversity and youth as a city, not as a city as in a young city, but the population is incredibly young and incredibly diverse. And that's very much, you know, every sports organisation, probably every business in the world, you know, that's what people want to connect with. You know, businesses don't want to connect with the likes of me, you know, who are towards the end of their working life and you know, happily looking forward to pottering around the garden a bit more. They want to connect with young people who they can engage with and they can have a lifelong relationship with, and they can get them into sport, they can get them into culture, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the Commonwealth Games Federation, as a representative of the Commonwealth, is obviously very diverse. You know, the Commonwealth is about diversity. So Birmingham plays very well to that, you know, in terms of outside of London. I would have thought Birmingham is probably the most diverse city in the UK by a mile, I would have thought. And obviously that goes all the way back to what we were talking about earlier on, back to my youth when you had the two-tone movement and all the rest of it. So, yeah, so that was Birmingham's pitch, was diversity and youth. And you know, and added to that, the sort of renaissance it's going through with all the sort of the building. And, you know, I think someone told me this was pre-COVID, so it's possibly not true now, but certainly pre-COVID, Birmingham had more construction cranes on its skyline than any city anywhere in the world.
Wow. Great stuff.
And that just shows you, you know, the sort of regeneration that was going on.
And I suppose that's the you said there wasn't, it's not a traditional competition, this one, but that's the kind of the external story. Do you think, did you have to also do the internal story, convincing Brummies this was going to be a good idea for them? Or was there less of that for a Commonwealth Games?
I wasn't involved in that. That's not kind of the area I get involved in. The Birmingham City Council team we did a great job on that. But, I mean, the challenge with these things is it's very hard to convince people that spending money on something like the Commonwealth Games or the Olympics is a good idea. If you took a poll or had a referendum, and in the Olympics, this has been one of the big challenges that they've had referendums, and if you ask the direct question, do you want to spend £10 million or £25 million bidding to host the Olympics, or do you want to spend £1 billion to host a major sporting event like the Commonwealth Games? The answer...
Is that really what we're talking about, those kind of figures?
Oh, you're talking huge sums of money. Yeah, I mean, the bids have become a lot more streamlined and a lot cheaper, but at the height of the bidding race, you were talking tens of millions of pounds just to hold... to be a bidder, right? I mean, Tokyo in 2016 spent hundreds of millions of pounds to bid and then lost. And that's a pretty hard sell for your mayor or your governor to go back to the population and say, well, you know, we spent £100 million or more, and we only got this many votes and we lost, but we'd like to do it again and bid again. Because, you know, you don't have to be a genius to work out the population are going to go, hold on, well, can't we spend this on something better? So it's a really hard battle to get that line, which is why you're seeing now a real trend of there not being bidding processes anymore. Instead of competitive bids, you have this new idea of dialogue. You know, an interested city will go and talk to the rights holder and they'll have a mature conversation, and therefore these deals get sort of done a little bit more away from the glare of publicity, so that you have less of those difficult conversations about, you know, how we can fund this and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if London had held a referendum before the bid, I don't think for one minute there would have been a positive vote to hold the London Olympics. But as I said earlier, at the end of it, after you've done the work and you've staged the event, you get 98% approval ratings. So it's a real conundrum.
Sorry, Nick, I'm still thinking about the stats and just how much money the French spent being told that they were egotistical and self-centred. It's been a terrible blow.
Well, this is the challenge. I mean, so the president of the IOC, Thomas Bach, came out with a very, very well-worn phrase a couple of years ago now that said that bid processes are really bad for rights holders because they create too many losers. You know, you create one winner. So that to go back to that London 2012 example, yes, you have a very happy UK and a very happy London team, but you have a very unhappy mayor of New York, mayor of Paris, mayor of Moscow, stroke President Putin, and mayor of Madrid. So you've created four lots of very unhappy people and one lot of happy people. And that's the problem with the old style competitive bid races.
And is this why we're coming to the end of the big bid era, Nick? I read an article you wrote recently. Welcome to the end of the big bid era.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So the most recent award of the Olympic Games, which may have passed you by because it was done on the very much on the quiet, is that Brisbane in Australia will host the Olympic Games in 2032. And that award was made without any competitive bid process at all. It was done in private meetings held between the city officials and the government officials and the IOC, who nailed it all out, sorted it all out, did all their due diligence and all of that, without ever going officially public on it in any really significant way. And that's what will happen.
Is that a good idea, going forward. Nick? I'm just thinking, you know, without being too overly political here, you know, it's an interesting decision for the World Cup to be held in Qatar this year, for example, which is not an open, you know, is it a good idea to have closed meeting rooms and people high up deciding these things?
I'm really 50-50 on this. I totally and utterly understand that the nuclear arms race, a cost escalation of bidding was unsustainable, clearly was unsustainable. I also get that, you know, a city like London or a city like Brisbane or indeed a city like Paris is far more likely to host if it doesn't have to go through the whole referendum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if London wanted to host again, and I think the Mayor Sadiq Khan is talking about that, you know, the process now is a lot less difficult politically for him to do that than it was in the past. However, you know, lack of democratic accountability and lack of transparency is a pretty big problem overall. And you know, in principle, yes, these things should be out in the open, I guess. But I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here. I think it's needs must. You know, if you go down the route saying, well, they all have to be old-fashioned bid campaigns, and they all have to have, you know, the Western democracies have to make sure they have public support via referendums, and there's unlimited budgets, you know, you're going to end up in a bidding arms race where the likes of Qatar or the likes of Saudi or the likes of, you know, China, all the countries that have got very deep pockets and very authoritative regime, shall we say, that don't have to worry too much about what the population think, you know, they end up becoming the bids that win time after time. And from a brand point of view for the rights holders, is that positive that they're taking their major events to those sorts of places time and again? You know, that can't be, that has to be a problem for them. So it's a huge conundrum, which thankfully I personally don't need to worry about too much. It's something that the IOC and host cities need to worry about.
That was a question that was absolutely littered with landmines, and I thought you trod that very well, Nick. Thank you.
Yeah, I've learned over the years to be a bit more diplomatic than perhaps I used to be.
Nick, I want to thank you so much for your time today. It's been fascinating finding out more about this. Obviously, these are big public events that we all hear about, and we celebrate when London gets the Olympics. We celebrate the Birmingham when it got the Commonwealth Games. Can't wait for it to come to Birmingham this summer. It's fascinating to understand some of the process that goes behind that and just how much goes behind that as well. So thank you for talking to me about that. And I think it's also great, as you know, we've got lots of old Edwardians who listen to this, but we've also got current students listening to this podcast, thinking about what their next steps might be, especially the kind of sixth formers who are thinking about universities, etc. And it's really lovely to hear that a dream or a thought that you had when you were 18 in the sixth form, to be part of that team that brought the Olympics to London. It's great to hear. Nick, I've got one question that I ask everybody to finish this podcast on, which is, can you name one thing, one characteristic that you think has served you best since leaving King Edward School?
I think one of the things that I learned from school and that I've taken on from it and has served me well is the given is hard work. I think Ian Metcalf mentioned this in his podcast, but you know, the things that have certainly drummed into me at school is that, you know, you've had a huge opportunity. You're incredibly lucky to go to this school, so don't waste it. Work hard and make the most of it. And I think that's kind of almost a given, frankly. But I think the other thing that I personally got from school that I've taken with me is a sort of sense of independence. And I don't mean independence as a sort of, you know, personal freedom, but independence of, you know, thought, independence of kind of mission, and just, you know, realizing that what you do with your life and how you run your career is very much down to yourself, and you don't need to be defined by anything else, really. You need, you know, it's down to what you want to do, and it's down to whether, you know, what you put in and what you get out, and also, I suppose there's also nothing wrong with changing your mind sometimes. It's the other thing, you know, just because you thought something at 18 or something at 20 or 30 doesn't mean you can't have a different path later down the line. I think for the younger generation, you know, the guys who are at school now, you know, when I left school, the expectation really was that most people would get a job in a certain profession and live their entire life being that profession. And I just don't think that's the way of the world anymore. I think people do have different chapters in their career and do take different turns, and I certainly have, and I've enjoyed every one of them. I've been very, very lucky.
Nick Varley, 1986. It's been wonderful to meet you. Thank you ever so much for coming on to talk to me today on Ed Talks.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk.